That's one thing that's really great about libraries. It's kind of like one public place that everyone is welcome. It doesn't matter your political beliefs, your gender, your sexual orientation, your religion, or you know, any of that. It doesn't matter. Everyone's welcome.
Becca, what are we doing today?
Road trip.
Let's go. Starting of the car is anticlimactic because it didn't go boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
Guess we could just go.
Yeah.
All right, so where are we going?
To the library.
Okay. Do you want to listen to some music?
Yeah. Welcome to the bookstore. It's like a book club, but we actually read the book.
I'm Becca, and what you're about to hear was recorded in 2019, before the COVID-19 pandemic. So you'll hear us discussing library services and how libraries function under normal circumstances. Right now, for many of us, this is not possible, but we can look forward to visiting a library in the future. So let's get into the episode. Today, we are here with Tom, who is the Adult Services Librarian in a library here in Michigan. So, Tom, hi.
Hi, Becca. Thanks for having me.
And I guess my first question is, what does a librarian do all day?
That's a really good question, and depends on where you're working in the library. There's actually only a few librarians working in our library. We have 5 librarians. They all have masters in library and information science. And the rest of the staff, the other 20-some people, are made up of circulation clerks who are checking in and out the books, placing things on hold, sort of managing the library's daily function.
Like sort of like the customer service end of it in a way, because
customer
that's like
service.
The library's members, I guess. What do you call people who have a library card?
We're going with patrons.
Patrons. Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
So, so the circulation clerks manage the daily functions, the in and out of the books, making sure the holds get placed in the right spot so people can pick them up. But we also have like the library assistants who are working at some of the more service desks, or you might call them reference desks in some libraries. And those are the people that are helping you, find materials, place materials on hold, and answer any questions. So if you're coming to say, hey, look, I'm looking for information about, you know, whatever topic, they're the people that are going to be helping you out.
So like, hey, I saw this book with a blue cover about 3 weeks ago on an end cap. They would be the ones.
Those are the people that are doing that. Yep.
Okay.
But they're also, people don't realize that, you know, libraries are a lot more than just books here, right? About half the time, I would say they help people with the computers too.
Oh yeah.
Filling out job applications, just how to do things with their email or on Facebook or whatever kind of random thing people don't know how to do on the computers, especially our computers here at the library.
Yeah.
Then they're working with those people to get that done. So those are, you know, some of the bulk of the staff that you see out on the floor, but we have cataloging and processing staff that are taking the books that come in from the vendors, wrapping them up in the book covers, putting the labels and stickers on, entering them into the catalog, you know, so that when you search on the catalog, you can find those books, because someone has to do that work in the back end. And then we have our youth staff, doing all the story times and the children's programs, homeschooling programs, and so on. You know, and it kind of goes from there.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of work that happens in the back end that people don't realize or they don't see every day.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I never even thought of, like, who puts the library covers on. I didn't know if it was, like, something done when you order the books, but it's actually done at the library.
It depends on the library,
okay,
right?
But
here at our library, we have 3 staff members that are in the cataloging processing department, and they handle all of that for us. The vendor we purchase from might stamp the books with the library's name,
okay,
but we put the book covers on, and then they handle putting all the stickers on.
Okay.
Other libraries, you can pay those vendors to, you know, sticker them and cover them and even do some of the cataloging for you if you want.
Okay.
But that's just not the route we've gone at this point.
Oh, so who does, like, the ordering? Who gets to choose what books you carry?
That's a good question.
At our library, we have two different people that are doing the ordering. So I'm the adult services librarian. I order all the materials for the adult collection. And then we have a youth services librarian who is handling all the ordering for the children's materials. And so between the two of us, we handle everything. Fiction, nonfiction, the DVDs, music, because we still have CDs, mm-hmm. some, and so on. E-books and downloadable materials and so on. Our library director has been handling purchasing all of our fun like things that we're checking out, like the Instapots and the metal detector and hotspots and all that. So she's been purchasing those things for us, and we handle all the books and other materials.
So how do you, and maybe this is like a very big question to ask, but how do you choose what books to carry? Is there like sort of a database where it's like, librarians, maybe you should order these books, or did publishers reps come here to try to convince you to carry certain books?
Sure. So, you know, if you're talking like publishers reps like Penguin Random House, we're not big enough, I would say, to have the reps actually come out typically, but we will have review material like the Library Journal to get reviews, and we can see the Publisher Weekly reviews, although we don't subscribe to that anymore. But also we're checking things like Amazon's Best Books of the Month and, you know, Goodreads and some of those other sources that you'll come across books. The vendors do have a new release calendar that they keep for us so we can see when books are coming out. For me, ordering for the adult collection, there's 200 plus authors that we have on standing order, right? Those best-selling authors, the big names that are coming out, James Patterson, Baldacci, Nora Roberts, Janet Ivanovich, and so on, that you know people are going to want to see in the library. And so we have those. Anytime they publish a book, we automatically get them. And I review that list once a year to make sure that it's up to date with new authors that are, you know, catching a lot of buzz. But from there, it's what else has been in the press, you know, what's going to be on in the media on the Today Show or whatever that people might have their attention caught by. And we make sure that we try and have those things in a timely manner.
I have a hard enough time just deciding what I'm going to read next. Right. I can't imagine trying to think of what everybody might want to read next. That must take it. How long does that take you? Well, I guess you probably do it daily, like figure out that stuff.
Yeah, you go a little bit at a time, you know, and there's definitely, like those standing orders for the best-selling authors, there's definitely tools that I use to help me. You know, we have the small mass-market paperback collection that is mostly just on a standing order for recommended titles that our vendor is recommending that we purchase. Because some of it, you know, especially being in a library our size, where there's only two people ordering, you know, you just don't have enough time to go through everything and make individual selections. So some of it is they recommend these are the top titles being pushed by the publishers. And so we'll just get, I think it's 20 of the biggest mass market paperbacks or, you know. So it's a little bit of that. And it's a little bit of, you know, more or less the type of books that are checking out at the library after you've been here for a while. Like, we don't have a very strong science fiction readership here, but it's important to have some of the bigger titles that are coming out. But I'm not going to dive deep into the lesser known ones, or sometimes the newer authors don't get into our shelves unless they are coming up in the bestseller list or they're working their way up on rankings on Amazon and things like that. And it's, you know, a little bit of a guessing game. You don't always know. Sometimes you get it right, sometimes you get it wrong. And people can always come to the desk and request materials, and we'll consider to purchase those.
So if you don't have a book that somebody wants,
sure.
Can you get it for them, like through an interlibrary loan, or how does that sort of work?
Yeah. So we have two or three options, right? So if we don't have a book already, and it's something that's relatively new, something that maybe is popular, maybe we should have, then we'll just go ahead and purchase it and add it to the collection. If it's a little bit older and or maybe a little bit more obscure, then we'll use our interloan system, MELCAT, because we're in Michigan. We have the Michigan eLibrary catalog to order books from other libraries in the state, which is, I would say, godsend, but I don't know what the right word is.
No, yeah, I use that all the time.
And so that's a great tool.
Because you're the only one? So you don't, because like Bay County is like all of Bay County, but you don't have a system.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we're just ourselves. So if we don't have it in the building, then we're going through Melcat.
Got to go to Melcat,
Or we're purchasing it ourselves.
So this is maybe a bit of a complicated question, but how do ebooks work? Obviously, when you order physical books, it's easy. You say, okay, this is a new release. I need 10 or whatever of these. But an ebook, it's slightly different. How do you order those?
So with ebooks, it is a little bit different. We have two different vendors that we use. Overdrive, which is probably the biggest vendor for library ebooks. And with them, we have to purchase the book more or less like we're purchasing a regular book. So we purchase a license for each copy of a book. So if we're checking out, you know, James Patterson's new book, I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head, but say we have James Patterson's new book. We order a copy, we get one license that can be checked out to one person at a time, and then as we do, you know, accumulate holds, we'll add more copies to that. And so that's one model that's going around through Overdrive, where we purchase a license, we can check it out. There's another vendor called Hoopla, and that's run through Midwest Tape. Their model is a simultaneous use kind of model. And for that, you know, if a book is available on that, it's available to everyone all at once, which is really cool for the end user, the patrons. But the libraries are being charged per checkout for those. And so we're paying for the books in a little bit different way. So with Hoopla, we're accessing their entire catalog. They have, you know, 500,000 plus materials with books and movies and music and audiobooks and so on. And with Overdrive, we're purchasing the copies for the collection as we have the budget to be able to add them. So we're doing a little bit more selecting or curating that collection than we do with Hoopla. That's just, we're sort of subscribing and it's all there for you.
Okay, yeah. So the cost of ebooks, I think most people think it should be, in their minds, they think, oh, it would be cheaper because you're not buying an actual book. It's just a copy and it's really easy to make more and more copies of ebooks, but it's not, right? It's actually significantly more expensive.
Right, yeah, especially for libraries.
Yeah.
You know, and even I think people feel that way with the retail versions of ebooks too, right? You know, you're paying $25 for a new book. You think, I shouldn't be paying $25 for this ebook. And you might get a little bit of a discount through the book retailers, through Amazon or Barnes & Noble or whoever you're buying your ebooks through. For the libraries, though, the publishers have made the decision to set the prices a little bit differently. So we're paying typically around $60 per book or per license for those books. And so each copy of that James Patterson book is $60 every time we have to purchase a new license. Or Where the Crawdads Sing, which has been, you know, immensely popular. We have over 400 holds on it, and we own, you know, maybe 10 copies, because that's usually about a cutoff to invest in one title for the ebooks. You know, again, you're paying maybe like $55 per copy, and it adds up really fast. Not to mention that some of the publishers have set like leasing terms on the titles, so that when we purchase the ebook, we're not, you know, purchasing that license and we get to keep it forever. It's, we purchase that license and we have it for 2 years, or maybe like 26 checkouts, and then we have to repurchase the title again after that. And so a lot of the publishers switched to that model just this past year. And, you know, 2 years from now, we're looking at a lot of work deciding what to renew, what to keep, and what to, you know, let go. And it makes doing things like keeping a whole series of a, you know, a title series in the collection very difficult.
Are those still $60?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Holy crap.
I mean, we'll see. It's supposed to go down in price a little bit, but we won't know until we get, you know, out there.
There was one, I can't remember the publisher, Macmillan, I think. They were going to do only, you can only get like one license.
Right, yeah.
For in the first 30 days of a new book being released.
Is that so they can sell it or something?
Yeah, because they think libraries are taking away their profits from people buying ebooks. Yeah, it's madness. But, okay. What else? So you mentioned sort of the very top of this that your district librarian or head librarian, whatever it was you said, I can't remember now, they buy other services like instant pots and stuff like that. What are some services that the library provides that people might not realize?
Sure. And so that'll be one of them, right, is that a lot of libraries have started checking out things or, you know, things other than books and movies that you might associate with the library, right? So our library director has started a library of things collection. And so we do have Instapots and metal detectors and hotspots and some of those things that you wouldn't expect to be able to get from the library. But I think, you know, a lot of people do think of the library and they think of just books, or they might think of, you know, taking their kids to the story times or going to story times themselves, and not consider that we have, you know, Wi-Fi throughout the building that a lot of people in the community take advantage of because they either can't afford it at home, they need a quiet place to study. We have computers for people, and we offer computer assistance, you know, to the best of our capability. You know, we're not Geek Squad, but we'll help people fill out forms and navigate through some of those simple problems. And we also make, at least at our library, we make one-on-one appointments with people. So if you get a new cell phone, you have no idea how to use it, you know, your cell phone company isn't helping you typically figure out how to, you know, get started with it and learn some of the ins and outs, we'll make those appointments and sit down with people and teach them some of the basic things so they can get started or at least feel more comfortable.
What
else? Where do you guys learn that stuff?
Hey, you know, you just pick it up as you go.
You mean it's not taught in library school?
No.
How to use an iPhone?
No, but you help enough people on the computers, you know, and you help enough people with their phones that things, you know, you start to get little tips. And it's easy stuff, you know, like they don't know how the calling function on their phone might work, right? They've never had a smartphone before. And so oftentimes it's seniors or, you know, people who are a little bit older and scared of using the technology that we're helping. It's not usually the 20 and 30 year olds though. Although you'd be surprised how many people don't know how to attach something to an email.
I am not surprised at that at all.
But there's, you know, and there's lots of other things that the library offers. Like for instance, last year we were running a legal counseling service. We partnered with Elder Law of Michigan, and we had free legal counseling for seniors because it's elder law. And we did that, you know, I think it was every Friday almost, and that was all virtual though. So we were setting up basically like a Skype visit with an attorney that was somewhere else in the community, and you could get some questions answered for free. And so we're trying to create access to some of the resources. And we bring in authors like you probably would expect, but we have lots of educational talks, and we have musicians come in and do concerts at the library, and there's all sorts of things happening at the library.
Yeah, I know ours does a yoga class. Okay, so who is allowed to use the library? How does one go get a library card? Who, I don't know what I want to say. Who's eligible for one?
Right. You know, honestly, anyone can use a library. You can just walk in the doors, take advantage of the computers, take advantage of the collection, the heat in the wintertime, you know, especially if you're homeless, the Wi-Fi. You can use the library without any sort of requirements, right? And that's one thing that's really great about libraries. It's kind of like one public place that everyone is welcome. It doesn't matter your political beliefs, your gender, your sexual orientation, your religion, or, you know, any of that. It doesn't matter. Everyone's welcome. To get a library card, though, and to actually take materials out of the library, we do ask that you have a driver's license or some sort of government issue ID with a current address, because we are, you know, liable for the materials in some way. The taxpayers are giving us money to purchase the collection, and we want to be responsible with it. And so if you do check something out, we want to be able to contact you and ask you to bring it back. And so we do have that requirement. Although recently we've been looking at creating different types of cards that people wouldn't necessarily have to have an ID for. And maybe they'd be restricted a little bit. You know, they could check out maybe only two books, but then, you know, they could still have access to some of the materials, the downloadable collection, and some of our e-resources. But there wouldn't be that hurdle of having to have an address or a permanent address, you know, that some people might have. So we'll see if we're able to make that happen down the road.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of libraries, and maybe this has been going on for a while, but only I've only noticed it recently, is there, like, you can pay $50 and then get one out of your district or something like that. Like, if I lived in Saginaw, I could go to Bay City and pay $50 and get a Bay City library card, stuff like that. So I think that's interesting too, and I think New York Public Library does that as well, so anybody can get access to their collection, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, and there's lots of libraries that do that. They have like a residency restriction, but there's an option that you can pay to be a member. A lot of the libraries in the area here do that as well, and the idea is, because the libraries are mostly funded by tax dollars, is that the people that are using the library or should benefit from it are the people that are paying for it. And so that's a really great model. I get it. But at our library, we kind of believe that the library is for everyone. And so we don't have any residency restrictions. So if you wanted to stop and get a library card today, you're welcome to do that. So literally anyone can come in and use our library.
Oh, wow. I did not realize you meant that. That's really cool.
What about kids that don't have, like, is that under their parents?
Yeah, so kids, right now here, you can do it two ways. So right now we require your legal guardian to be with you if you're a child to get a library card. After you have that library card, you can just come in, check out whatever books you want. They don't have to be with you to do that. But we also understand that some kids, like, their parents aren't interested in coming to the library or taking them to the library. But they're here after school because they don't have anywhere else to go until they're, you know, parents get home or their guardians get home or whoever. And so we do have some of those, we call them connect cards, where they can check out two books, they can access the computers with those cards, but they can sign up for the card themselves. And so it gives them access without those unnecessary steps. So there's still some restrictions, but they can still access the collection in the library and they're not blocked, right? It's like an equity issue.
Yeah, that's really, really nice. So a lot of libraries are ending late fees. Are you guys still doing late fees? And how does that work? What do the late fees go to? Like, what's the purpose of them, I guess?
Right. So right now, we've been following that conversation, you know, amongst libraries. We did stop charging late fees for our children's materials this past summer. So that's pretty cool. And we're looking at maybe next year, we're still looking into it, but maybe stopping them altogether. So that could be coming in the future. The late fines, you know, the money that's generated from those, goes into just sort of the general budget for, you know, whatever it is it's going to pay for. It's just part of an income line, and then the, you know, the expense line is budgeted out separately, right? And so they could be going to pay for books, it could be going to pay for building maintenance issues. And so it is a source of income, but at the same time, it's kind of another barrier for people. You know, in the one sense, you have the group of people who think, oh, you know, late fines, we need that. You know, people need to learn responsibility. But in the other sense, you have people who can barely afford groceries who want to access books at the library. And, you know, then they bring a book back late, or two or three, or you check out 20 kids' books because it's easy to check out and you want your kids to have books. But now you have all these fines and you can't pay for them. You know, who are those fines hurting the most? And it's going to be families like that that don't have the money to pay that money back. And is it really necessary to charge those fines at all? So we'll find out.
Yeah, the kids book, not charging fees for the kids books, I think is just like probably the first step a lot of libraries are doing and should do,
right?
For sure. So whenever we do interviews, whenever we have people on the podcast, we always like to ask, what are some book recommendations you have, or any books that you're excited that are upcoming maybe for next year or for 2020 when this comes out?
Sure. I just finished Recursion by Blake Crouch. Have you read that at all?
No, but I've seen it.
It's everywhere. Coming up on some of the like top lists of the year. You know, I'm really excited to have read that. You know, I read Dark Matter, which was a great book too. So I would recommend that, you know, as one of the books. And it's, you know, it starts out with this detective who's trying to talk this woman off like the side of the building. You know, she's ready to commit suicide and, you know, take her own life. And he's saying, you know, what's going on? He's trying to talk to her. And she says, I have all these memories, you know, from this past life that never happened. And they're calling this false memory syndrome, FMS. And it's like all of a sudden you have memories of a completely different life, but they are kind of dead memories, right? They're a little bit more hazy in your head. But she still remembers her marriage to this guy and her son who she knows she used to have. But in her current life, you know, none of that exists. And she just can't take it anymore. And this FMS problem keeps popping up, and it seems to be infecting people who are in contact with other people. And so this detective is going to, you know, research this. But what it turns out is that someone was working on, and this is only halfway spoilers, right? Because, you know, a little bit of spoilers. But it works, you know, there's a scientist that's working on trying to help her mother who has Alzheimer's. And she wants a way for her mother to relive some of those memories that she's going to lose soon in the next year or two. And what she actually makes is a way to step back into those memories. And when you step back into them, you're like resetting the timeline for everyone, not just yourself. And so that's where all these false memories come from, because this guy that she was married to had lost a wife a long time ago, and he decided, well, I'm going to, you know, find this mystery company or whatever that he found somehow, and I'm going to reset my life and go back and save my first wife. And so that impacted his second wife and anyone who remembered the marriage. And you can imagine the problems that this would cause, you know, as more and more people start jumping back in time and resetting things. Because as I change my life and my bad decisions, it affects everyone else because I'm reliving all of those and making different decisions, right?
It's the butterfly effect.
It's like, yeah, the problem with time travel is what it's doing, right? It's kind of explaining that.
Yeah, yeah. And it was told in a really weird way. You know, it's an interesting twist on it, I think. And I just really enjoyed it. And so, of course, the world is going to collapse, right? Because everyone's like resetting all their memories and no one knows what's real anymore. And this guy is trying to figure it out. You know, and he bumps into the scientists and they're working together.
That's been big on Goodreads, too. A lot of my Goodreads friends have read that. Yeah, that's good. So is there anything else that you're looking forward to that's going to be released in 2020? Right.
If I'm looking forward to something, it's Max Brooks has a new book coming out, The Evolution, a firsthand account of the Rainier Sasquatch Massacre. And, I mean, how can you not even, like, be interested in that? It's just the best. And if you read World War Z, you know, that was all told in, like, interviews. And I just can't, you know, I can't even wait. So this is a great book. And if you're looking for something similar to that, I read a book called Into the Drowning Deep by Mira Grant, where it's this reality TV show company is taking a group of scientists out to the Mariana Trench to investigate, you know, see if they can find mermaids. And they do, but they're not like the little mermaid, nice singing, lovely mermaids. They're the eat your face off kind. So, and that was excellent too.
Yeah, I read World War Z and the Zombie Survival Guide, which he did too.
Right.
And I love Bigfoot, so I'm adding that to my Goodreads to be TBR right now. What is it called? Devolution?
Yeah, however you say it. Devolution? De-evolution?
Okay. Well, I think we'll go on a little tour of the library, if that's okay.
Sounds great.
Actually, this is where we are going to end the first part of this two-part episode. Thank you for listening to The Bookstore. If you enjoyed this episode, please let us know on our social media, Patreon, through a podcast review, or you can leave us a voicemail at 616-730-1656. You can find all of our contact information on our website, thebookstorepodcast.com. We would love to hear what you thought of this episode. Thank you again, Tom, for letting us visit you at your library. The Bookstore is a production of Awkwardly Social Media, produced by Becca Yunk and Corinne Keener, with technical and production support by Josh Bourdon and Zach Titus. See you next Tuesday. Bye!
It usually takes me like an hour to tour people around the building, so...
You can only go about 14 hours on there, so it's just letting you stay under 14
hours. I'm not going to take 14 hours. It's not going to happen.